This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping the local area. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builder Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Covering a diverse array of topics on this program every day, we wanted to come back to a topic that gets a lot of attention from time to time, and that is the topic related to forest management, a lot of different issues surrounding that. And Ken Carlone with us, Vice President of Umpqua Watersheds. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
And first of all, I'll talk a little bit about your background. I know that you were a professor for a long time. And talk about some of the things you've done that kind of leads you to the perspectives you have.
Sure. You're correct. I was at Umpqua Community College for 31 years. I taught a range of biology and natural resources programs, develop a natural resource program in conjunction with OSU there. Since I retired in 2018, I've devoted a lot of my attention to ecosystem restoration and biochar production, and we can, you know, maybe another show we can talk about what that means. So the focus most recently has been on forest restoration and how to manage the forest in such a way that it is productive, resilient, supports biodiversity, stores carbon, and produces timber for local economy.
So the Forest Service put out something related to the old growth issue in their forest plan recently. We talked to Nick Smith of the American Forest Resource Council a week or so after that, and kind of wanted to get sort of, this is sort of like the counterpoint to the point situation, get your perspective on that, because I know you kind of came to a different conclusion.
I did, and I did listen to that conversation that you had with Nick, and wanted to rebut a series of points that he made. But the first point that I would like to make is that federal forests belong to all Americans, and we passed laws in the early 70s, Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, that all need to be supported by the way we manage our environment. And since industrial lands have far less regulation on them than public lands, it's up to the public lands to shoulder most of the burden of maintaining species, maintaining clear water, and so on. And so protecting resources on public lands is the job of the federal land management agencies, and they have a series of rules and a set of objectives, and they follow them.
Now, take a look at sort of what you've seen in recent years with how the forests are managed in this area, the federal forests. What are your thoughts about what they're doing?
Well, what you can see, and especially this is especially evident in the what we call the BLM checkerboard, where every other square mile is public land versus private land, and so we can see these side by side comparisons of the ways that the land is managed by industrial managers versus public managers, and we have a lot of good data for how wildfire is the big focus here. How do we manage our forests to maintain that resiliency against resistance to wildfire and resiliency after the fire burns through? And when you look at public lands, and there's this narrative out there that public lands are being poorly managed, and that's the reason that we have these catastrophic quote-unquote wildfires. But if you look at the recent fires, the 2013 Douglas Complex fire, the Archie Creek, and the 2020 Labor Day fires, just as an example of a few of those, what we see, and this is documented in peer-reviewed scientific literature, that private industrial lands experience a lot more high severity fire. And the reason for that is simple. If you line up all your fuel in a row, Everything is planted at the same time, largely all the same species. All the crowns are at the same height. They're all touching each other. When a fire rips through there, it pretty much incinerates those stands. When it hits the old growth stands, that's when it tends to hit the ground, run underneath those old growth forests, and back into the canopy. Now, what happened in the Archie Creek fire and in the million acres of the Cascades that burned in 2020 is that we had a climate-driven, wind-driven fire where in the first 24 hours of the 140,000 acres of the Archie Creek fire that burned during that fire, 95,000 acres burned in the first 24 hours when the wind was blowing hard. When the wind stopped blowing, the fire tended to drop to the ground. And what we saw is that, so as that fire was burning and the wind was driving it, federal forests and industrial forests were burning at about the same rate. There were a few percent less severity on public land than private land. But once the wind stopped, the difference was dramatic. Private lands burned a lot harder than public lands did. And again, because you have so much more old growth there, you have a lot of structural diversity. So it's really about, it's not about the volume of fuel, the amount of fuel out there, it's about the structure of the fuel. And if you have a very chaotic old growth forest out there, it's a lot harder for fire to travel through that because that crown is all broken up. When you get into the plantations, the fires just rip across the surface. And so the most flammable forests on the landscape are the industrial forests.
Now, and this would run counter to what a lot of times you hear from the industry regarding thinning and clearing out of areas.
Right. And so certainly in plantations, in already managed forests, and we're not talking primary forest here anymore. We're not talking about old growth or mature forest here. Thinning can be useful and is very much something that Umpqua Watershed supports, counter to, again, the narrative that we want to lock up the forest, we don't want to touch the forest. That is not true. We have never opposed a thinning sale in already managed forest, and we've supported a number of projects in late successional reserves and older forests. If they're legitimately driven by restoration drivers as opposed to extraction.
Now, you've worked with this for a long time. I'm curious how you got into this whole area kind of as a career, working on forest studies, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I arrived in Oregon as a 25-year-old after I'd finished my master's degree at the University of Connecticut, and did a stretch of tree planting when I was here, and began to look at the forest and begin to understand how forests worked here in the Pacific Northwest. I had never seen a clear cut growing up in New England, which is where I grew up for the first 25 years of my life, and so. I began to study and learn and try to educate myself as to how forests worked and what the effects of management was on that forest. And again, as the peer-reviewed scientific literature came in, and of course that's my perspective, I'm always looking for the science to back up the thoughts I have and the statements that I make. And so that's what kind of led me here to this point here. And then I wound up getting a PhD in forest ecology from Oregon State University back in the late 90s.
Wow. So out here now, if you were in Connecticut, what about Oregon was it that got your attention?
You know, it's the fires. And historically, the Native Americans burned, at various rates in various places across the U.S. and across the world. And in New England, you can't burn a forest down there because they're hardwoods. They're oaks and maples and beeches and stuff, and they have a lot of moisture in their leaves, their broadleaf trees. They don't have the resins in the needles like most of our conifer forests out here. And so Indians there underburned their forest, and they grew, grapes and huckleberries and those sorts of things. And of course, the corn, beans, and squash that the three sisters that they're famous for. Out here, you could burn a forest down because, all the resin in the conifer forest. And so they did create meadows, and they maintained those meadows with fire. And so that was the focus of my PhD work, is how did the previous management regime, of the folks who are now extirpated from the landscape, compare to the more modern forest management that we started to see around the turn of the last century and on into really the 90s when the Endangered Species Act looked at the spotted owl as an indicator species for many other species, by the way. It's not just the spotted owl out there. It's all the other species that are old growth dependent species. And that's what triggered the Northwest Forest Plan in the 90s. And that's what brought logging down from about 12 billion board feet a year to about 3 billion board feet a year on federal lands.
All right, King Carlone is with us from Umpqua Watershed. He's going to take a break. Back with our second segment in a moment. The interview, a podcast after one at 541radio.com. 1246 at News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1248, Lars Larson coming up at 1. Umpqua Valley Live, looking at arts, entertainment, and community events with a lot of guests today at 4 o'clock on Monday. County Commissioner Chris Boyce will be in to talk about the new fiscal year budget, some of the current priorities for county government. Ken Carlone, former professor at Umpqua Community College, retired now, and I understand you're doing a lot of consulting work.
Yes, I am. Forest restoration work, how to bring forests back into the conditions that they were under when Europeans first arrived. And again, as I say, my research was related to that. So taking the landscape management of the past, looking at the landscape management of the last century, and then looking at how do we solve some of these problems and what can we learn from the past to bring forward into the future to help inform our decisions there.
It's been interesting to watch this issue for quite a while. One of the things I've noticed is that when you look at what I would call, and there's probably a term to this that's better used, but the management practices of the tribes, mm-hmm. that you seem to find things that are kind of, I don't want to say somewhere in the middle, but kind of in some ways, there's some things they do that seem more long-term based than maybe sometimes from the industry.
Sure. And this is one of the things, Kyle, where I think we can bring forward some of that, what we call a traditional ecological knowledge. And that is that the Indians burned here on a regular basis. And a lot of the open meadows that we see in the Umpqua Valley today there's more trees in some of those places than there ever were, because those meadows were burned on a very regular basis every couple of years to maintain the open meadows. That's where the camas grew. That's where the deer went. That's where their food and their fiber and their medicine came from. But what's much later to the game for us to understand is that they carried fire all the way up into the forest. And if they burned in under the right conditions, those were underburns, just like the New England forests. And so you could burn out the undergrowth, create, again, food for the deer, your own food, huckleberries that they followed elk up into the mountains and that sort of thing. And they were creating the habitat and the conditions for their food to grow. So they didn't have to be active agriculturists, right? They were animal husbanders and plant husbanders. Just by maintaining, using fire in the right time and the right place, they could create the conditions that gave them all the food and fuel and fiber and medicines that they needed. And so in order to be able to get our arms around this wildfire problem, what we need to be able to do is decrease the flammability of the forest. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the most flammable stands on the forest are the plantation stands that were created by clear-cut logging in the last century. And so on federal lands, we are very much, watersheds and scientific community in general, very much supports the idea of thinning in those already managed stands. And the question might come up, well, if you're going to thin in those managed stands, why don't you thin in the primary stands as well, the old growth stands? And my answer to that is, let's do the easy stuff first. Let's, you know, because thinning in plantations, we all know how to do that. That's done on a regular basis as pre-commercial thinning and that sort of stuff. And then let's learn our lessons, make our mistakes in the managed forest, and then let's think about how we want to manage the unmanaged forest, the old growth and mature timber.
So what are some of your other thoughts from what the Forest Service has put out recently?
Again, it's been referred to as a quote-unquote political document, and I don't understand that, because if you look at it, it's full of peer-reviewed science. So it is a scientific document. And again, you hear this idea that the federal system is broken. It's not broken. It's functioning, and 25% of our timber comes from federal land. And so and there is a very good definition for old growth here. I've heard it said that, nobody agrees on what old growth. We do agree. You know, old growth is large old trees, dead standing and downwood, multi-layered canopy, high degree of native biodiversity, and critical ecosystem functions. Just to give you a quick example of one of those functions, impaired watershed studies that were done in the 60s, where they clear-cut one old-growth stand and left the other, what they found was that even 50 years later, the peak flow, or actually I should say the low flows in the summertime, are twice as high coming out of old-growth forests than plantations. Plantations suck a lot of water out of the ground, put it into the air, and therefore our salmon fishery and that sort of thing suffers from the amount of clear-cutting that's been done up in those forests.
As you do your work, and obviously, you were one of the founding members of Umpqua Watersheds, right?
Yes, I was.
And what was your hope there?
Well, what brought all of us together as Umpqua Watersheds was this incredible spasm of old growth cutting in the late 1980s. And what we realized was that this really is a not old growth is a non-renewable resource unless you want to wait 300 years. And so what we were trying to do is protect the last stands of old growth in the Pacific Northwest. And so that's what was really the motivation for us to come together as Umpqua Watersheds. And initially, we were saying no, 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 which is what we had to do because, you know, massive amounts of old growth was going down. But now we've sort of evolved more into saying yes. How do we make this work? How do we come together with other folks, like the Private Forest Accord, for example, you know, is a good example of in this case, private timber and conservationists coming together and finding real solutions. And I think we can do that here as well. But we have to understand what the problem is before we can go out there and solve it. And the problem is that the flammability of the forest is based on forest structure, and forest structure is based on past harvest. And in the research that's been done, in areas with the highest levels of protection, you find the lowest severity wildfire.
How do you work through an issue this complex and have these discussions with people that have totally different viewpoints? I'm sure those have got to be a kind of a stressor.
It is. And but what we always fall back on, and because we hear this word a lot, science-based, blah, 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 right? Science-based management, science-based. And so we say, okay, well, here's the science. And so then what unfortunately happens is that people will start putting air quotes around science, because if they don't like it, they don't consider it to be legitimate science. But we have, science has a process called peer review, where experts in the field will see the paper ahead of time before it's published, will critique it, and will fix whatever problems are in there, or the paper gets rejected. And so peer review is the bedrock of how science works, and peer-reviewed science should be the bedrock of how we look to manage our forests.
Now, do you feel like there's been too much stereotyping sometimes from both sides?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I understand, you know, folks in the industry are, you know, they're beholden to their shareholders. You know, they need to do what they need to do. And so, you know, none of what we do at Umpqua Watersheds has to do with private land, right? We own, you and I, you know, and everybody here listening, owns the federal land out there. And that's where Umpqua Watersheds focuses its efforts to say, you know, this is a public resource. And if we want to maintain all of the things that the American people want to maintain on those lands, we have to really roll up our sleeves and get in there and figure out how to not only protect and preserve certain areas, but also how to manage other areas so that we don't lose the areas that we want to keep.
About 30 seconds left. If people want to read more tied into what you've talked about today, where would you direct them?
UmpquaWatersheds.org, all one word. There's a lot of information there. And you can read our blogs, and particularly what I'm talking about today, the restoration blogs, and we are we support active management in appropriate areas at appropriate times, and so we want that stereotype to go away.
All right, Ken Carlone from Umpqua Watersheds, thanks for coming in.
You bet.
1258 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. A daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. It's presented by Concrete Builder Supply. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it around and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications. Stay connected with local news and information. News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.